Baruchim Abayim, ladies. We are studying today Parashat Lech Lecha. Today's class we will study Lerfuah Shelema Aharon Chaim Ben Ruhama, that God should give him Lerfuah Shelema. He's undergoing an operation as we speak. As was mentioned, we are studying Parashat Lech Lecha. Lech Lecha literally means go. God is telling Avraham Avinu that he should leave his birthplace, his father's house, his country, leave and go to a land that I will show you. That land was the land of Israel. Rabbis comment, why the double language? Lech Lecha. God can say, Lech, just go. Lech Lecha is a double language. So I saw two nice interpretations from a rabbi called the Baal HaTurim. The Baal HaTurim says, Lech Lecha, if you count the letters, Lamed is 30 and Chaf is 20. That's 50. Lech is 50 and Lecha is 50. It's the same letters. That's 100. So he says that God was hinting to Avraham Avinu, who at this time was 75. He said, all these blessings that I'm telling you, you're going to have children, and you're going to have beracha, and you're going to have a succession of descendants. That's not going to happen until you're 100. So he was alluding to it, that Avraham Avinu was going to become a father at 100 years old. Lech Lecha. It's going to happen at 100. Another interpretation might be that at this time Avraham was 75 years old. Avraham lived to the ripe old age of 175. So God was hinting to Avraham Avinu his time of death. God was saying, from now until you die, Lech Lecha. You have 100 more years to accomplish and to achieve perfection. Hachamim, specifically the Ramban and others, count this as one of the 10 tests that Avraham Avinu endured. Going to a land that he doesn't know. God didn't tell him where he was going. That's not an easy thing, to just to leave your birthplace and start traveling to an unknown destination. I wondered myself if a great rabbi would come and tell me, you know, you have to leave America, you have to leave New York, you have to leave Brooklyn, and take your whole family and go. Well, where should I go? Just go. Go on Nosha Parkway and just go north. When should I stop? I will tell you when to. Just go. How much food should I bring? I have a business. I have a responsibility. Just go. Don't worry. So it's not such an easy test just to pick up and leave everything you have and go to an unknown destination. But Avraham Avinu went without any question. So that's the way the test is understood. And he passed it with flying colors. But if you look at the words of the Pasuk, it says that God promised Avraham Avinu that when he gets to the destination, he's going to be blessed to become the father of a great nation. He's going to be blessed with wealth. He's going to be blessed with fame. All good things. All things that people strive for their whole life. To have a family, to have success, to have honor. And God is telling him, in the most clearest terms, I'm going to make you a great nation. It means you're going to have a lot of children. You're going to have a lot of money. Your name is going to become great. You're going to become famous. Everybody's going to know Avraham Avinu. Now, if that's the deal, that's not such a big test anymore. What's the big test? If God says, listen, I want you to go to an unknown place, you're going to become a billionaire in that place over there, you're going to be the father of a great nation, you're going to have everything at your disposal, everybody's going to know you, you're going to have great acclaim. So Avraham goes. And they say, oh, he passed the test. Of course, who wouldn't go after you promised all these perks, after you promised all these benefits? So I heard an explanation that really we can apply to our own lives. Avraham Avinu had a test before this that the Torah alludes to. Just in passing, the Torah says that Avraham Avinu was challenged by the king of his time. The king of his time was a fellow called Nimrod. Nimrod was an atheist. Avraham Avinu was a monotheist. He believed in God, and they had a debate. And at the end, Nimrod took Avraham Avinu and casted him into a fiery furnace. Avraham Avinu was willing to die for his convictions. miraculously he came out of the fiery furnace unscathed. So that was a great, great ness. And again, he passed that test. One rabbi said that test might have been easier than this test. Why? Jews have an uncanny ability to rise to a moment of greatness. We saw Jews throughout history, whether it was in Spain, whether it was in Germany, or whether it was any other countries where we were persecuted by Goyim, that Jews rose to the occasion not to subject themselves to their oppressor, die Jewish, not bow down to the idol, not kiss the cross. The Jewish people throughout history had moments of greatness where they were willing to sacrifice their lives for Borei Olam. And we all know the stories. But one rabbi pointed out, that's a moment's test. So for a moment to achieve greatness, to psych oneself up, to get oneself excited to serve God for a moment, might be easier than to live through a constant test. To live through a constant test, which is day to day, that becomes much more difficult. Which means if you tell me it's a 5-second item, you just have to do it, it's finished, over, it's easier to do. But if you have to endure, let's say, God forbid, somebody's going through a crisis in their lives. So it's unending. I mean, at least it's open-ended. You know, you don't know when it's going to end. So it's just every day and the same challenge. And you have to keep composure and you have to keep your respect and you have to keep your dignity and you have to keep your patience. So that's a test. That's not a 1-second test or a 5-second. If you to jump into a fire, you just have to motivate yourself for a couple of minutes. You jump in, khalas, it's over, it's finished. But to live through a test is much more difficult. So Avraham Avinu over here now, he has to go to the land of Israel. God told him. Okay, he gets there. What happens? There's a famine. Oh, now he could start second guessing. God, you told me to come here. I got here. I relocated my whole family. I brought a whole entourage with people. I know you promised me the world, but I don't see. Forget about money. There's not even bread to eat. Forget about wealth. We don't even have basic necessities. So Avraham Avinu has to leave Israel, go down to Egypt for a while. He goes down to Egypt. The king takes Sarah hostage. Sarah, Abraham's wife, the Sadiq, and now is in Paro's palace because Paro wanted to marry her. And now Abraham Avinu has to figure out a way to get her released. The whole one problem after another. His nephew in the interim gets taken into captivity, so he's got to go fight a war against 4 or 5 kings in order to recover Lot. So this was a test. That wasn't over the course of one day or one week. This was a test that spanned a few years. That's a much harder test. It's much harder to live in sacrifice than to die, Chas v'Shalom, in sacrifice. Which means, when we talk about somebody giving up their life, that's a moment of greatness. But to live under circumstance, that's much more difficult. And that's our test. We should all have a long life, but our day-to-day, we're constantly being tested. Every single thing Mishilat Yesharim writes in his book, every single moment of a person's life is being tested. Will he make the right decision? Will he make the wrong decision? I don't want to make you paranoid, but maybe it's not so that every second. But the point is, we are tested so many times a day. Should we be courteous? Shouldn't we be courteous? Should we go back and say a good word, or shouldn't we? Should we do something for our children? Shouldn't we? We're always constantly making decisions. Much harder to live like that. Guy jumped in the furnace, it's over. He did one mitzvah, he goes to Gan Eden. But to live with sacrifice, that's much harder. That was Avraham Avinu's test. And that shows that's great people. Great people not necessarily have that one moment in life. Great people usually are successful at the small things in life, at the everyday, day-to-day things. That's what they excel in. That's what Avraham Avinu's test over here was, to go through a span of a few years with confusion. God told me to go to an unknown place. He promised me wealth. Where's the wealth? There's no food. I have to go to Egypt. What happened to my wife, my nephew? So all these things are working on Avraham Avinu for him to say, enough, that's it, I had enough of it, leave it alone, I'm not going. Let me go back to my father's house. Let me go back to my community and finish. But the fact that he was able to endure all the day-to-day inconvenience, all the day-to-day, what jadas, the problem, all that stuff, that made this test greater than other tests that happened in a flesh, in a moment. There's a famous Ramban that I think it's mandatory for everyone to know as we start to study about the lives of Avraham, Yitzhak, and Yaakov. The Ramban writes in several places, in this parasha as well, that Avraham, Yitzhak, and Yaakov were not, I'm going to say not normal human beings, but that's obvious that they were anything but normal. They were super special, super human. They were beyond comprehension, as a matter of fact. Avraham Avinu, says the Ramban, anything he did in his life had repercussion throughout Jewish history. Which means Avraham Avinu created through his deeds the destiny of our people. The way he says it is Ma'aseh Avot Siman Labanim. The deeds of our forefathers were a premonition to what is going to happen to the children. If you study Avraham, Yitzhak, Yaakov's lives clearly, you'll see that many things that they went through repeated themselves in history. I'll give you one example that he brings. One example he brings is Avraham Avinu goes into the land of Israel. And the first place where he pitches his tent, where he makes settlement, is next to the city of Ai, Ayin Yud. The Navi tells us hundreds of years later, when Yehoshua ben Nun went into the land of Israel and conquered the land, one of the first cities that he conquered was the city of Ai. Which means the seeds of that conquest of Yehoshua were planted hundreds of years before when Avraham Avinu settled in that place. That wasn't merely a pit stop for Avraham Avinu. It was, okay, he got the eye, so he pitches his tent, and next. He was creating history. And if you could follow Avraham Avinu's footsteps wherever he went and whatever he did, you'll find how he was actually creating the future for Klal Yisrael. I'll give you another example. Another example that the Ramban brings. The Ramban says, for example, Avraham goes down to Egypt because there was a famine. As a result of the famine, he's there. Paro, who was the king at the time, takes Sarah, as we mentioned. God is angry with Paro for taking a married lady. God subsequently brings great plagues on Paro and his household. Paro asks forgiveness from Avraham Avinu and rewards and gives Avraham Avinu compensation. Avraham is escorted out of Egypt with great wealth. This exactly was the setup situation for what's going to happen to Avraham Avinu's children. Many years later, there was a famine in the land of Canaan. Yaakov and his family went down to Egypt. They ended up staying in Egypt for 200 years as a result of a famine that brought them down to Egypt. In Egypt, Paro had a plan, a diabolical plan, to drown all the Jewish boys, and to keep all the Jewish girls alive. Exactly like Paro had many years before, to keep the Jewish women alive so he can abuse them. God, as a result, brought plagues on Paro. The Eser Makot, Dam, Sephardeya, Kirim. And as a result, the Jewish people left Egypt with great wealth. But who set that whole scenario into motion? When Avraham Avinu was going down to Egypt, that already was a premonition everything that he did in Egypt repeated itself in history. When we went out to Mitzrayim, when Paro got plagued, when we left with great wealth, that already shows you that the Avot, in a way, were creators. Of course, there's only one creator, there's God. But they themselves created. There's this famous Zohar. The Zohar says on the Pasuk, Ele toledot ha-shamayim ve-ha-ares behib bare'am. This is the story of the world, of the heavens and the earth, when God created them. Behib bare'am. Says the Zohar, behib bare'am is the same letters as be-Abraham. The Torah, according to the Zohar, is saying this is the history of the world that God created, the Abraham. And Abraham was similar to God in that just like God created and fashioned the entire world, Abraham, Yitzhak, and Yaakov, their actions, they also became the precursor for whatever is going to happen to Am Yisrael. That's why we must study their lives with such a seriousness, and have to study every action that they did in order to understand exactly why things happened to us, and maybe even what is going to happen to us. Because if they did it, that means rest assured it's going to come out sometime in Jewish history. That's why the Gemara says you only call three people Avot, Avraham, Yitzhak, and Yaakov. There's only three of those. You can't call Yosef, for example, Yosef as-Sadiq, you can't say Yosef Avinu. Anybody who says Yosef Avinu, it's Avon. You can't say even Moshe Avinu. Moshe Rabbeinu, but not Avinu. There's three Avot, there's three fathers. They had the ability to create a legacy for their children. Ma'ase Avot, Siman de Bani. In the Perasha, we read how Abraham, on his travels, what do the Pesukim say? Vayatak misham ahara mikedem lebet el vayet aholo. He got to a place and he pitched his tent. He pitched his tent. Now, if you look at the way the Pasuk spells the word tent, or his tent, it should be spelled Aleph. He lamed vav, aholo, ohel shelo, his tent. But if you look at it the way it's spelled aleph he lamed he, which can be read ahola, that he pitched her tent first. So from here the rabbis learned that when Avraham Avinu was pitching his tent, out of derech eretz, out of respect, he pitched the tent of his wife first. So aholo is not his tent, he pitched Sarah's tent first. So the question is, why? So the Siftei HaChamim explains, because the Gemara says, Hayav Adam lechabed et ishto yoter migufo, that a person has an obligation to honor his wife more than his own honor. And therefore, Avraham Avinu followed this dictum. When it comes to honor, the honor of the wife comes before the honor of the man. That's what Harambam writes. And therefore, now Avraham Avinu's the wife of Avraham, Avraham Avinu is a prince, but Avraham Avinu is a nobleman, Avraham Avinu is a king in his time, Avraham Avinu is a Sadiq, Navi. But look at the respect Avraham Avinu has for his wife. You'd think that Avraham Avinu would say, I'm Avraham Avinu. She has to pitch the tent for him. But no, Avraham Avinu goes out of his way to show you. Now, if Avraham Avinu showed such respect for Sarai and Menu, how much was incumbent for spouses to show respect for each other, that he gave all the honors to his wife? Hachamim even tell us that there's a Gemara, there was a rabbi called Rabbah. Rabbah said an idea, how to get rich. He said, if you want to get rich, he told the men, Okiru neshaychu, honor your wives, in order that you become wealthy. And he proves it. He says, the Pasuk says, Ul Abraham hitiv ba'avura. God was generous with Abraham because of Sarah. Because Avraham Avinu respected Sarah, and he was good to Sarah, and he honored her, so God rewarded Avraham with great wealth. So this is something that every husband should know, every man should know. You can tell your husbands this. The men's class tomorrow. Yeah. But I want to understand why. What's the logic? Why should this be so? A man honors his wife, so he should become wealthy. And I guess the opposite can also be true. So what's the explanation? Explanation, this is conjecture. You don't have to accept this, but this is what I feel. Since when does respect bring money? What's the measure for measure over here? So I think the concept is like this. When a lady is doing so much for her husband, and it's not recognized, and it's not appreciated, so then already, not only a lady, but anybody's self-esteem, anybody's confidence is broken. I mean, you're doing, there's no word of encouragement, or there's no word of gratitude. So that can make a person feel like nothing. He's doing and doing and doing, but not getting any reciprocation. When a husband goes to a wife and says, beautiful dinner, delicious, or whatever the compliment is, so what you're doing is you're giving your wife a worth. You're saying to your wife that she has a value, that she has an importance. So God says, measure for measure, you gave your wife value, you gave your wife a self-worth, so God in return gives worth also to the man. Now to a man, he doesn't want a compliment, he wants money. He wants to be complimented that he has a nice thigh, he doesn't care, don't compliment me, give me money. So therefore, measure for measure, you elevated the worth of a human being. So therefore, Borei Olam elevates a man's worth by giving him a great beracha. This is what we're seeing. That's the greatness of Avraham Avinu. That's something that you might pass over. You talk about the great test that Avraham Avinu did. This is the small test that just get lost in the shuffle of the great things Avraham Avinu did. But the Torah goes out of its way to tell us this also. The small things, when Avraham Avinu pitched his tent, you have to know he pitched Sarah's tent first. That also blends into the greatness of Avraham Avinu. Not only the Akedat Yitzhak, not only the things that he did on, the main stage of life, where he's remembered for doing things, jumping into a fiery furnace. That's also important, but you also have to remember the small things. That he had such honor and such kavod for his wife, and that's what makes Avraham Avinu great as well. And without this, he's not Avraham Avinu, because otherwise the Torah wouldn't mention it. So that's mentioning you the different components that make a giant of a man of his caliber. Torah goes on in the Perasha and tells us another lesson about Avraham Avinu. Pasuk says that Lot, his nephew, was taken into captivity. There was a major world war that was taking place. Four kings against five kings. For practical purposes, that was World War I, where every kingdom in the world was at war with each other. And Avraham Avinu hears about his nephew Lot that was taken into captivity, so he goes with his little army. He had an army of 318 soldiers. Shows you how wealthy Avraham Avinu was. He had his own army. Must be very expensive to maintain a personal army on premises. It means the army have families. So Avraham Avinu was supporting 318 families to be his personal brigade. I don't know if Bill Gates has a personal army of 318 soldiers, as wealthy as he is. I don't know if he has 318 butlers in his home, but Avraham Avinu was a man of, he was richer than these people. He was a magnate. The man had his own army. You snap of the finger, they get the ammunition, and they go fight a war. It's an amazing thing. So he goes to the war, and he saves Lot. The king of Sedom was very grateful to Avraham, because Avraham also saved a lot of other people that were in captivity. So the king of Sedom tells Avraham, I want to pay you. I want to give you compensation. You helped us in the war. I want to give you a gift. So it says, Vayetze melech Sedom lekrato. The king of Sedom went to greet Avraham. Vayomer Avraham el melech Sedom. So he says, I'm not taking anything. The way he says is, Harimoti yadi el Hashem. I'm raising my hands to God. I'm not taking anything. I won't even take a shoelace from you, he says. Meaning I won't even take a red penny. I don't want a cent from you, he tells him. So you could go around saying, oh yeah, I made Avraham rich. I don't want any of your money. Keep your money. Just give me, tell me a nefesh. Give me Lot. Give me the captive and keep your money. I don't want anything from you. So he doesn't take anything from him. But the rabbis point out that Ramban says, what was he telling the king of Sedom? I raised my hands to God. Tell the king of Sedom, keep your money. You don't want to take the money from this guy? Keep your money. Like you said, I don't want it. Keep it. I don't want the money. I raise my hands to God. So one rabbi explains, raising his hands to God means he was making a shivua. He made a swear. I swear when a person raises his hand, usually he makes a swear. Like, you know, they raise your right hand and make a vow. Make a swear. Avraham means, I raise my hands to God means I swear to God, I'm not taking your money. Others explain that he raised his hands in prayer. Please God, save me that I shouldn't have to take this man's money. Another rabbi says he raised his hands and he said, this money is harem to me. This money is forbidden. It's consecrated property. It's forbidden to me. Whatever the explanation is, wouldn't it be enough just for Avraham Avinu to tell Melech Sedom, keep your money? You're making swears, you're making haramim, you're praying to God. From here you see another ingredient, what makes Avraham Avraham Avinu. People have a weakness when it comes to money. Even money that doesn't belong to them. The Yetzer Hara rationalizes. Nah, you deserve it. You earned it, it's okay. You'll give 10% to charity. Anyway, you're not spending it on yourself. You're spending it on your children. It's not for you. When it comes to money, people lose their clarity because they want it. So therefore, their decision-making is all blurred. And it's all slanted. Everybody always thinks that they deserve it. And they can, the Yetzer Hara can play on them 100 ways. That's why you have to be very careful when it comes to monetary issues to try to ask somebody that's objective, a third party who can see clearly exactly if the money is yours or not. Avraham Avinu is now being offered money. Avraham Avinu says, I don't want to get tainted over here into rationalizing. So what does he do? In order to protect himself, he puts his hand up. I swear to God, I'm not taking this money. Finish, that's it. It's over. I swear to God already. Which means he built a fence for himself. Or he prayed to God, please God, Harimoti et yadi el Hashem, I raise my hands to God, please God, protect me that I should not succumb to this test to take dirty money. He felt it was dirty money for whatever reason. But you see over, that's the greatness of Avraham Avinu. He didn't trust himself. We live in a society today where, for some reason, people trust themselves that they will not fall to sin. Parents may send their children away to different colleges that they may live on campus and spend time in dormitories, and the parents have a very mature attitude. They say, what do you mean? I trust my children. I don't suspect them. And when they hear, somebody religious saying, yeah, but you know, the dangers and the pitfalls. Well, you don't trust your children. How did you raise your children? If you can't trust your children to... On the contrary, you see over here that the greatest Siddiqeen knew the power of Yetzer Hara. They didn't trust themselves. Avraham Avinu didn't say, I'm Avraham Avinu. Keep your money. Avraham Avinu said, I got the money. I swear to God, I can't take this money. He started to build fences. He started to protect himself so he can't fall. In order to teach us that one has to have a certain amount of fear that he might come to sin. And therefore we cannot put ourselves in situations and say, don't worry, nothing. I'm okay. I'm better. I told you a story once of the great Gaon, Rabbi Eliyahu Lopian, where one of the boys in the yeshiva came to him and asked him, he wanted to go to a certain wedding where it was going to be... not modest, a young boy in the yeshiva. So he tells the rabbi, I'm going to such a wedding, but don't worry, it doesn't affect me. I'm okay. So the rabbi said, I'm 90 years old, I'm blind in one eye, and it still affects me. And you, it doesn't affect. And if it doesn't affect you, you have to go to a doctor because there's something wrong with you. Don't deny the fact that you're a human being. And because you're a human being, we have different yetzirah. But to come along and say, no, I can go there, nothing's going to happen. Avraham Avinu was scared of himself. Therefore, he had to make... We're learning now in the halakha, in the daily halakha, we started to review the laws of Yehud. Our religion has great emphasis, and I think this is one of the beauties of our Torah, to show you how ahead of its time it was, how progressive our Torah was. This is a law that was created 2,000 years ago, even more. The laws of Yehud basically say that there are many situations where a man and a woman that are forbidden to each other are not allowed to be secluded, not allowed to be alone. Husband and a wife, of course, that's permissible. But we're talking about somebody with somebody else's wife, even alone in a room without anything. There's nothing more than that. But it's forbidden. And there's so many laws, who you're allowed to be, what time, the day, the night, doors locked, doors open. Can somebody walk in? Is it... And you think to yourself, what are they getting so crazy for? We trust each other. Like, just going to be alone with a lady, you're going to make a horn. A lady's like, we're advanced. We're not animals. But Harambam writes that the key that leads to sin does happen. There's things that lead to sin. So Hachamim was so smart. They said, we don't even want to get you to come to sin. So therefore, you know what, you can't be secluded. We don't want you to be alone. Because once you're alone, your threat can play on you and something kind of can lead to Avon. Now, if society today would believe in the laws of Yehud, it would be a different society. All the trouble that you read in the newspapers start where? Where people are secluded with each other. You mash them over Zichro, you read about basketball players that was secluded into hotel rooms. If this guy would follow the laws of Yehud, he would never get into a problem. What are you doing secluded into a room with a lady for? Our Torah will never let you get to that stage. But that's the basis of what? That there's a certain, we don't trust ourselves when it comes to Yetzirah. The greatest Chachamim didn't trust themselves. The Avot the Kiddushim made fences for themselves. So for us to come along and say, what kind of Torah is that? What, they suspect if you're going to be alone, you're going to do it? You're denying human nature. You're denying the weakness of human nature. And then you're denying the ability of the Yetzer Hara to cause someone to sin. Therefore, all these fences that we have are vital in order for us to keep the law. I'll say one more idea towards the end of the Perashah, which I think is also quite fascinating. In the end of the Perashah, we learn about the birth of Yishmael, the father of all the Arabs. The father of the Arab nation is born. Actually, his mother Hagar prayed to God that she should have a child. The angel comes down and says, Hagar, behold, you are going to have a child. Not only are you going to have a child, but God says that you're going to name the child Yishmael. That name already was predetermined by God. And then God tells us a little about the character of this child. V'hu yiyeh pere adam. He is going to be a wild man. Pere adam. That's the definition of what Ishmael is. That's his resume. That's his personality. Two words. Pere adam, a wild man. Untamed, unbridled. The Hafiz Chaim said that is the nature of the Arab. It's an untamed, uncultured, uncivilized, it's a pere. Even if you have a doctor or a lawyer or a professional or a professor or a teacher, it's still a pere. It's the same untamed, unbridled, just with a degree. But that wildness is a inborn nature of Yishmael and his descendants. The Hafiz Chaim in 1930 already was concerned, and he said, and he woed, and he sighed, and he said, who knows what this Pere Adam will do to our people at the end of days. And today already we see the wildness of such a people, unprecedented by any other people, to go and to blow themselves up with shameless acts, unconscionable acts. This is only done by a nation that can be a pere. One rabbi said, grammatically, in Hebrew, usually we put the noun and then we put the adjective. For example, if I want to say he's a good boy, I say yeled tov. Yeled is the noun, the boy. Tov is the adjective, describes the boy. Yeled tov. You don't say tov yeled. The pasuk should have called Yishmael Adam Pere. He's a person that's wild. So I heard from one of the rabbis, they were saying, no. The noun is a pere. He is a pere. That's what he is. You want to know what type of pere he is? Adam is the adjective. He's a wildness that happens to be a human being. But his essence is pere. That's the noun in this situation. And this, if there's ever a generation that understands this wildness and this pere, it's this generation. But what always bothered me was, and now I think I understand it, if you were Hagar, and God just told you that you're going to have a child, and he's going to be wild, and he's going to be uncontrollable, he's going to be a pere, what would your reaction be? You'd start crying. You'd start telling, please, what avon did I do? Please forgive me. No, please, I want a sadiq, I don't want a pere adam, which means she got the child as a result of her prayers. So it's not like she doesn't know how to pray. So when God gives her the bad news that she's going to have a crazy, uncontrollable beast as a son, so Hagar should say, please, Borei Olam, you got to do me a favor. I don't want this type of child. I want a Yitzhak, Yaakov, I want Tzadikim. Her reaction is very telling. Maybe now we can understand that today we're seeing an unprecedented reaction when children blow themselves up in the name of jihad and their mothers are being interviewed and the mother Arab says, we're proud, and the mother says, we're so happy, look what he did. And sometimes the mother that's buckling the child up in order to go destroy. In the history of the world, a mother has love of a child more than anyone. It's natural that a mother's innate reaction is to protect the child, to save a child. And here, the mother has no problem that their children are wild beasts. This came from Hagar. When Hagar was told that she's going to have a wild beast, she said, okay, fine, beautiful, I have no problem. And that nature was passed on to all the mothers that you see today, that they see their children wild animals and they say, we have no problems, good, beracha, we're lucky, we're so, we couldn't wait, our chinuch paid off, all our education, whatever they're saying. But there's one other thing I want to tell you about Yishmael that the Torah says. The Torah says about him, yado bakol, v'yad kolbo. Literally it means his hand against everyone and everyone against him. Rashi explains, Yado bakol listim, his hand is everywhere, meaning they're going to be thieves. The Yishmael and his descendants are going to be dishonest, they're going to be crooks. V'yad kol bo, and everybody's hand is going to be in them. It says, Hakol sonim oto, Rashi says, everybody's going to hate them. They're going to be a disliked nation. But what's fascinating here is the way the Targum, Unkelus, which is a commentary that was written over 2,000 years ago, the way he interprets these words. Yado bakol, he explains, vida dechol bene anasha, I'm sorry, he explains, hu yehet sarich lekola, yado bakol, he's going to need people, V'yad kolbo vida dechol bene enasha yehun sirichin le. And everyone in the world is going to need him. This is the way Harry explains it. Now I ask you a question. 2,000 years ago when this rabbi made this interpretation of a pasuk that everybody's going to need the Arabs, 2,000 years ago, what could an Arab give the world? Sand? What is he going to give them? Cock? What is he going to give them? What commodity can an Arab, that the whole world's going to need the Arabs? 2,000 years ago, they didn't have jet planes. 2,000 years ago, they didn't have automobiles. And they had no need for gasoline or oil. But this rabbi explained that the Torah was saying there's going to come a time where the whole world is going to need these people. Today, it's obvious. Today, if it wasn't for the oil that was produced in these Middle Eastern countries, then already the world would have done away with these people and had much less patience and tolerance. The only reason why this country has any tolerance for Saudi Arabia is only because of the commodity that, imagine that, we need them. They're in a position, they have something that we don't have. Yado bakol v'yadko. That was the blessing of God. God already blessed Ishmael before he was born. And he is going to have all the oil and all the gasoline, and everybody's going to need him. Why did God do that exactly? That's another subject why he does it. But I will say one thing, and I'll conclude with this, that it is interesting that, we think we said this, but it's worthy to repeat, that if you go through the Middle East, all those countries in the Middle East are so super saturated with oil. Wherever you go, you just dig in any of the backyards of these countries, whether it's in Dubai or Kuwait or Saudi Arabia or Iraq, you see these drills drilling oil and revenue, so it's $1 billion of resources. But you go to Israel, which is supposed to be God's country, the blessed country and everything, and you dig and dig, there's no oil. You can't imagine. You go across the border, they're digging oil, but in our country, God's oil, is no oil. What was the logic? So I heard a theory once, which I think is the truth. God did that on purpose. Just think for a second. Would the British ever have given back the Jewish people the land of Israel if there was oil? Of course not. How would they give it back? What would they give it? The only reason why they gave it back to us because they said, there's nothing. What's worth it for us? It's rocks. It's you can't even produce. Not even there's not even trees over here. So then Borei Olam did us a favor. He kept the land unappealing so our enemies will not be interested in it, and therefore they'll give it back. Little did they know that once we get it back, we were going to turn it into one of the most beautiful countries and the most civilized countries. So therefore, it shouldn't bother us so much that there's no oil in Israel. But it's clear that Borei Olam predicted. Borei Olam knew, and the commentaries predicted, that the Arabs are going to be needed. Yadoba called the Yad called, well, everybody's going to need their commodity. Have a good day, guys.